Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
It is a beautiful fall day. It is Sunday, September 18th. Welcome to the Kudzu Vine. This is Tim Shiflett coming at you from the mountains up here in northwest Georgia. And as always, Catherine is here. Hello, Catherine.
Hello. Greetings from Atlanta, Georgia.
Also, I guess you folks noticed that David isn't talking. David has taken the night off as he is in Atlanta to watch his beloved Falcons. But sitting in his place is an old friend who's been on the show several times, a lady I've known for a long time, a great Democrat, a great campaign worker, just a wonderful person, Wendy Davis. Good evening, Wendy.
Well, thank you so much, Tim. It's always a pleasure to be with y'all. Thanks for letting me join you from gorgeous Rome, Georgia. It's almost like I can see the leaves changing now. It's such a beautiful day. Feels like fall.
Oh, yeah. Now, in just a few minutes, David Neer from Daily Coast is going to be our guest. You might all recall that he was on a while back, and we very much look forward to talking with him again tonight. And while we're waiting for David to come on, we're going to do our usual, and we're going to touch on some of the political news right now in the news. And, Catherine, I'm going to turn to you because you went to Dublin yesterday, and you were at the GADCC dinner and the state committee meeting. And tell us what all went on down there.
Well, actually, I got to Dublin on Friday night because, you know, who doesn't want to spend a whole weekend in Dublin, Georgia? So we rolled in on Friday night, and I had a chance to hang out with some of my favorite Democratic friends in the little Longhorn across from the hotel and just, you know, hung out and had a few cocktails and talked with people. And then bright and early Saturday morning, we all headed over to the Mid-Georgia Technical College and the Dubose Porter Conference Center, and I started with a meeting of the congressional district chairs where we talked about some of the strategies we have going forward for 2012, and you know what we're going to do about getting the vote out, and you know working with the Obama for America campaign and all that kind of stuff. Then I had a communications committee meeting, which was also a lively discussion about our message and how we're going to, you know, put that forward. Meanwhile, there were, you know, a variety of other meetings, including the GADCC, the Georgia Association of Democratic County Chairs, had their executive committee meeting. It was a lively bunch of activity at the Dubose Porter Conference Center. And then we had a state committee meeting in the afternoon, and we talked about some potential bylaws changes. We got a report from R.J. Hadley, who's the congressional district and county chair's liaison, vice chair from the DPG, talking about what's happening in the various counties and how things are going with that. And Miguel Camacho, who's our recruitment chair, talked about his ideas of we're going to be looking at the districts in which President Obama and Roy Barnes got more than 50% of the vote, but we didn't run a candidate in them for state House, state Senate. So we're going to be trying to find some candidates to run in those districts. And then we had a great little video from Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the chair of the Democratic National Committee, filling us in on what's happening with the Obama for America campaign and, you know, just sort of asking us for support and help and congratulating us on a lot of the new initiatives that Chairman Verlon and Paige Gleason, the executive director, are working on. So it was nice to hear from her, and she's very informative. And then we were really fortunate to have Alice Tremont, who's the secretary of the Democratic National Committee, there live to give us a little pep talk and fill us in on what she's working on as the secretary of the DNC. She also addressed the dinner later that evening, so that was really, she's a really great Democratic activist, has been in politics for many, many years, and was very warm and inviting and generous with her compliments to Mike and Paige, and was really quite entertaining and told a lot of fun stories and that kind of thing. And then we had the dinner, and which was, I must say, a little less well attended than I kind of expected. It was still a lot of fun. State Representative Tyrone Brooks received the award this year, and our friend and fellow Kudzu Vine guest from A Time to Time, Melanie Gu, also got an award. So it was a really great day and evening of Democratic politics and activists and everybody. It was really, really quite entertaining. One highlight for me was Stacey Abrams addressed the crowd at the dinner, and she was absolutely on fire talking about redistricting and all the things that she's been working on. She was really fantastic, and you know, it's always exciting to see and hear from her. She was very good. So that's all I have to say. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I looked at the coverage on Blog for Democracy, and I guess what I was looking at was the state committee meeting itself. And it didn't look like a huge crowd. You mentioned the crowd seemed like it was down a little bit, even at the dinner. And I've been to meetings like this, and I know Wendy has, where they have state committee meetings at remote sites, you know, around the state. Went to one in Rome once, as a matter of fact. And do you think it's a good idea, Catherine, to hold state committee meetings in places other than Atlanta? Do we get anything done by doing that?
Well, you know, there was a lot of discussion about that yesterday, I must say, especially after, and we always have the Young Democrats always host an after party, and we always talk about the day and how things went. And, you know, I think there's value in going out to other locations and meeting Democrats from those locations and giving everyone around the state an opportunity to get somewhere where they might not, like, you know, it's a long drive from, like, Valdosta to Atlanta. But it's also a long drive from Rome, for instance, to Dublin or Valdosta or wherever. So I think I think it's good. The one thing that I think is good about it is that it does stimulate the economies in these smaller communities, and that's important. It's important as Democrats that we recognize how important it is for these smaller communities to get, you know, people to come in and hang out at their Longhorns and use their hotels and go to their little conference centers or whatever. But as far as getting good attendance, I think it is a challenge. It's a long drive. And in my case, I had to be there early Saturday morning. It's a 2.5-hour drive. Fortunately, I was able to go in on Friday night and spend the night and, you know, go to a hotel. I shared it with a friend, but it's, you know, it's still an additional expense. And then if you go to the dinner too, you know, you get out of the dinner at 9:30, and you really probably don't want to drive 2.5 hours, though many people did. So I think it is a challenge, and we have our next meeting is December 3rd, and one of the things that was announced yesterday is that Paige Gleason will be resigning her DNC seat. So there will be an election at the next state committee meeting on December 3rd. To fill that seat for the remainder of that term. So yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of discussion about how we make sure that we have a quorum, whatever, though there's a lot of questions about exactly what a quorum is for that election. And we also might have some bylaws changes. So I think it is a challenge to figure out, okay, well, if we hold it in Atlanta, chances are good that we can get a quorum because there's, you know, the lion's share of our Democrats are in the metro area. and it's a shorter drive and all that. But then, you know, I heard a lot of people from, I talked to a couple of people from Valdosta, I talked to some people from Savannah and from, you know, Columbus, LaGrange, who are like, well, you know, why do we always have to go to Atlanta? And, you know, it's not a simple answer. I wish it was like, well, we have it in the middle of the state, but then everybody has to drive, and you get there, and, you know, I said to somebody yesterday, okay, so I drove here, I spent the night, I come to the first meeting I went to on Saturday morning, 85% of the people in the room were from Atlanta.
Let me let you jump in here with this, Wendy, because in your job, you know, working with the party and also working in all kind of campaigns from the local up to the highest federal levels, I'm sure you've been to meetings like this, not all over Georgia, but just frankly all over. So I guess I want to ask you the same question. Is the party getting anything done by moving these events or these not only dinners, but meetings like this away from the state capitol?
I do. I have always been a person who was an advocate for moving the meetings around the state. And I think what we haven't done yet really is in a consistent way to do that. You know what I'm saying? It kind of ends up being a sporadic, well, somebody, you know, finally gets tired of being hollered at by everybody in South Georgia, so they go put an event in South Georgia. You know, I mean, but I think if we made it a little more routine, you know, and sort of did kind of an every other meeting outside of Atlanta, I mean, because the reality is most of the members of the state committee are in Atlanta. But the reality is that we haven't been working outside of Atlanta to build up our counties to, you know, add people to the state committee from those counties, you know. And so it's a little bit of a chicken and egg kind of problem of if we don't do the outreach, we're not going to get the people. And if we don't have the people, you know, it can be disappointing sometimes, the turnout. So I'm someone who has, again, always been an advocate. But I think if we could find a way to make it more routine, and we're going, you know, to the northeast part of this, you know, we're going to do an Athens thing and sort of rotate, you know, maybe clockwise around the state and, you know, with an Atlanta stop, you know, in between those outside of Atlanta stop. I just think it's very important. We have made a mistake as a party, frankly, it feels like for decades now, of these areas of the state that are furthest from Atlanta tend to be the most, veering Republican most often. And so we think, well, we don't have a lot of friends there, and so we don't go there, and we don't compete, and we don't field candidates, and so we're not going to make any progress there.
I was going to throw in, and Catherine can jump back in here on this because she was there. Dublin is the hometown of DuBose and Carol Porter. And yet Catherine said that 85% of the crowd there that she saw was from Atlanta. Isn't that a little surprising?
Well, here's what I think. I agree with Wendy absolutely that that reaching out into those communities is really important. And I would be happy to do that. But I think if you're just going to hold a meeting and then have a dinner, you're not really reaching out to potential Democrats in the area. I'm not saying that it's not a good idea, and I agree with you. I think we should have these meetings around the state. I think it's a good idea. But I just wonder if it might make more sense, you know, we were talking last night, like maybe we do something more public while we're doing it. You know, maybe, you know, we go in on Saturday, we have our meeting, and maybe break in the middle of the afternoon and go, I don't know, knock on some doors or go to a local festival or something and show that we're actually there. Because the only way people really knew that we were there was, like, the people in the hotel knew because we had a block of rooms. The people in the restaurants knew because we walked in and, you know, there's 50 of us, and they're like, oh, those are the Democrats. We're going to put them over here in this corner. I agree with you. I think, and this actually did come up in conversation last night, with some people from further south, who were saying, you know, you never come down to Valdosta. You know, I said, well, you know, invite us to come and help you with a specific activity, and
right.
I think you'll see that people will come. But to ask all of our state committee members to drive as much as 6 or 7 hours to come to Valdosta for a meeting is a little bit of a challenge for people who either can't afford it, can't afford the time, can't afford whatever the reasons that are a barrier for that. So I think reaching out outside of Atlanta is very important. I'm just not sure that this is that kind of outreach. Do you see what I mean?
I think the meeting that was in Augusta, if you'll pardon the interruption, I think was a better example of how to do it. Because I think the opening of the headquarters there,
right.
you know, gave a big boost to the local Democratic Party. It got them on TV. You know, it gave them a chance to rally around something and to feel like they had a local impact by the state coming to them.
I think you're absolutely right about that.
You guys are saying then that these meetings would carry a lot more punch if they were accompanied either by something big that the Democrats are doing in the county or by something big in the county that might be going on. I don't know, Wendy, say like the Chiahaw Festival in
right.
Floyd County, something like that, or a big fair. Or is that what y'all are saying?
Yeah, that's what I think. I mean, I'm not, you know, I've gone to Macon or Dublin, like, what is this, like the fifth time or something for the GADCC dinner. And I'll always go. I'm, you know, I'm a pretty devoted state committee member, and I'm a congressional district chair now. So, you know, I'm fortunate that I can afford to spend the night in a hotel one or two nights, and I don't mind that. I recognize that there are people that aren't as fortunate as I am financially and can't always do that. So, I'm just not sure how we balance that. I think that, you know, the GADCC dinner has been in either Macon or Dublin pretty consistently, except last year when it was in Athens, when it coincided with the state convention.
So I say Rome,
I think,
next year.
All you got to do is lobby.
Okay, well, we will keep an eye on all of that, and while we're still waiting for David Neer to call, we hope he's going to be calling us here in just a minute, we'll start moving around to some other political stuff that's going on around the country and talk about it. And on this subject, I want to touch on this one. This old boy lives in New Orleans, and he's known as the Raging Cajun. He first made a national name for himself by orchestrating Bill Clinton's victory in 1992, and in recent years he's been a contributor and a regular on CNN. Now this week, James Carville raised some eyebrows with some remarks he made. This was in an opinion piece on CNN.com, and it was titled, "What Should the White House Do? Panic." Well, he said, among other things, that a bunch of advisors should be fired, that the attorney general should indict some people in the financial industry who've helped direct the economy. He said the president should start acting like a Democrat, pretty much, and that essentially the president should make a point and then stick with it come hell or high water. Wendy, is he right about any of this?
You know, I don't think, you know, I think James, like, was looking for a little attention, and especially saying it's time to panic was a bit much, but I think he had some good ideas there. Clearly the team that did such a great job communicating during the campaign, I don't know where they went or if they just all got so exhausted they don't have any juice anymore. But they have, frankly, failed miserably, in my opinion, to get things done. I love the idea about indicting some people. There's certainly a lot of people in the financial services industry who did a lot of bad acts that have hurt all of us across the country, and I think that's not a bad idea.
Yeah, but Catherine, what does it say about the state of perhaps the president's reelection chances when somebody of James Carville's stature speaks out this strongly?
Well, you know, I have little patience for James Carville, I'll be honest with you. I think that Wendy's absolutely right. He must have been feeling like he wasn't getting much attention and wanted to, you know, sort of get his name out there again for whatever reason. You know, I agree that, you know, there's some indictments that should come down and that President Obama has not been the, how do I say this? He has not been as outspoken and critical of some of the behavior that's been going on both sides. I mean, I think there's been some, you know, like Amy said, some bad acts that haven't been properly acknowledged. But mm-hmm. I think that, you know, the right now is not a good time for a Democratic strategist to criticize the president.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that Alice Germond reminded us of yesterday at the GADCC dinner is all the things that he has accomplished, and I wish that we would spend some time talking about that. We spend very little
mm-hmm.
time, and I think that might be one of the reasons that that it might be wise to replace some of his staffers, that I think there's just not enough acknowledgement of all the things. You know, the guy walked into a presidency that had so many challenges in front of it with two wars and the economy and all these other things happening, and then we've had, you know, sort of remarkable amounts of other things happen with the storms and the, you know, all these things happening, and I think he's handled things with remarkable poise. But you know, maybe what we're looking for is something not quite so poised.
Yeah.
Maybe we want someone who's a little more angry or a little more fired
you
up.
Know,
and I wonder
I was
sometimes.
Gonna say. That's what I was gonna say, Catherine. Passion and fight. I know he is a cool, calm individual, and this is general demeanor. But just every once in a while, you know, when he made that speech, the jobs bill speech, and the speeches he's made since, hey, there's the guy I've been looking for right there. That's the guy that, do you agree with that, Wendy, that
yeah,
perception is everything?
Exactly. I mean, we all know perception is reality, and
mm-hmm.
and although it has probably served him well to, you know, get through the obstacles he's had in life, that he's calm, cool, and collected, unfortunately, it can come off as aloof. And there are so many people who are hurting. I mean, suffering in this nation, and him staying calm. And trying to, I mean, always reaching out his hand to those Republicans who are biting it off time and again, trying to find compromise and trying to be reasonable. And there are people out here who are losing their homes, and it feels like he doesn't care because he's not
mm-hmm.
fighting. Because we want somebody to fight and stand up against, you know, all these big shots who have everybody fighting and screaming for them. The folks, us little people, you know, we thought he was going to be in there battling for us because that's what we thought
mm-hmm.
hope and change were, that the big shots weren't going to be in charge anymore. Regular folk were going to be, you know, have a voice. And it's like nobody's listening. Nobody's hearing the pain. He's not acknowledging all that anger. And it's hurting him.
I agree completely.
Catherine,
I think that's really, really good way to put it, that, you know, we don't see him acknowledging our suffering, and I think we look for that in a leader. We look for someone, you know, I mean, Bill Clinton was masterful at it, absolutely masterful, from
mm-hmm.
the, you know, I feel your pain to, you
yeah.
know, always being able to deliver a story about you know, someone's struggle and how they, you know, all those Clinton-esque deliverables were really amazing. And and I think, you know, we like a president who's cool and calm in the face of international crisis. I think we all, well, I know I appreciate that. I look for that. But with all that's going on in this with us in this country, I think we are looking for someone who's, you know, fired mm-hmm. up and ready to go. Wasn't he fired up and ready to go at some point?
That was the plan.
Let me just ask y'all then. Do you think it would help at this point for there to be a shakeup in the West Wing, some new faces, some fresh blood and ideas?
I can't really say what is best for President Obama. I have to trust that he's, you know, selecting people that are, you know, advising him the best way for, in the West Wing. However, I do think that he himself needs to be a little more fired up. And if that means hiring some new people to advise him in that way, so be it. But it may not be what is needed. It might just be a change in his attitude or strategy.
Yeah, I don't know if shakeup is the right thing to do in terms of, like, because then that becomes a new story. Who's asked why?
But Wendy, you have worked in a presidential campaign at pretty much the highest level. What would you advise this president to do then as he looks forward to next year's election?
I would advise him to stop being Mr. In the Middle and Mr. Nice, and I would tell him to start drawing some lines in the sand and very clearly communicating. The successes he has accomplished, he is not communicating. He is, what the message Alice Germain delivered apparently to the state leaders yesterday is not a message that's getting out to everyday Americans. And he needs to take his victories for what they are and gather a few more around him. And if the Republicans just insist on being obstructionists, which they're going to be, he needs to be calling them out on it all day, every day. He needs to be fighting. He needs to be battling, and I don't think it takes new staff to do that. I think it takes him deciding that he's got a battle on his hands and he's got to fight.
Well, Catherine, in 1948, Harry Truman ran against the do-nothing Congress. Could President Obama do the same thing?
You know, I think it's really hard to look at what we've done in the past. The climate and the landscape have changed so much that I just don't know what we learned from previous elections. With, you know, I mean, everything is all out there in like nanoseconds now. And I think every move has to be so strategic that, even just thinking about, you know, even if they just hear, well, he's going to campaign against a know-nothing Congress, a do-nothing Congress, just the idea that, just floating that idea gets everybody in Congress fired.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's not what they're
going to do. In other words, it's an age of instant news changes everything, huh?
Exactly, and I don't pretend. I mean, I think Wendy's probably a much better has much better comments about this, because I don't pretend to know what that strategy is. I just do feel that. I mean, I do think that people are very unhappy with Congress. I mean, you look at the approval numbers, and it's just shocking. And maybe that is the strategy, but. It sounds
so
like
kick
a strategy
them while they're down. I'm just saying he's got to kick something. Kick Congress. I mean, he can't keep playing not to lose. he can't keep being safe and not wanting to take a stand that might be the wrong stand. He's got to own some things and make them happen. And if he can't make them happen, make sure everybody knows it's the other guy's fault that these good things didn't happen.
Yeah,
I'm not
absolutely
saying that's an easy thing to do, but that's what I'm saying he needs to do.
Well, while we're kicking people around, let's move now to our favorite new Republican to talk about here on the Cuds Do Vine. And, of course, Catherine knows immediately that we're talking about Governor Perry, because he sure is giving us plenty of material just about every time he opens his mouth to speak. And with that, I'm going to stop right there and wait on that, because I believe our guest has joined us. We are delighted once again to have on with us Mr. David Neer from Daily Coast. Welcome back to the Kudzu Vine, David.
Pleasure to be back. Thanks for having me again.
Now, since you've been with us previously, and our listeners pretty well know all about you, we can just jump right into some good political talk here. And the very first thing I'd like to talk about tonight is the results of that special election up there in New York to replace Congressman Wiener. Now this is a district that Wiener won with 60% of the vote, and the president carried 55% there, and yet we lost that district the other night by a margin of 54 to 46, and what I wanted to ask was that vote simply a referendum on the president, or was there more involved there?
You know, I thought we were going to be talking about Southern politics, and you managed to bring
yeah,
it back to my hometown.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's a complicated question. And
uh-huh.
I think that there are a lot of people who maybe want to give overly simplistic answers to what happened in New York's ninth. I think there's no question that unhappiness, pretty serious unhappiness with the president, played a role. But I also think that there are some decidedly local factors that don't exist perhaps anywhere else in the country that really meant a lot in that district. New York's 9th Congressional District really has some unusual demographics. And even in New York City, there's no other district like it. So I know it's a little bit of a weasel answer. I think it's both local and national factors. That said, if I'm the Democrats, and I am, I'm a partisan, I'm definitely not too thrilled with the results and not feeling so great about 2012.
Well, that was going to be my next question about it before we did turn south. What should we read into these results in relation to other future races, or is that such a good idea?
You know, it's always risky. In 2010, just last year, earlier in the year, the political environment was looking truly terrible for Democrats, and we had a special election in Pennsylvania's 12th congressional district, a real blue-collar working-class district kind of voters who seemed that they were going particularly hostile to Democrats. It was Jack Murtha's seat, and Democrats won. Mark Kritz held the seat in a special election, and, of course, it unfortunately didn't mean a damn thing for our fortunes in 2010 because we sure got killed. So
yeah.
It always makes me nervous to read too much into special elections. If we want to sort of get into the nitty-gritty on New York's ninth a little bit, you know, you have certain factors such as a very heavily Jewish population, but not just Jewish, but heavily Orthodox Jewish, where sort of more hawkish views on Israel really seem to matter a lot. There seemed to be unusual distrust of President Obama. But at the same time, you know, you have issues with unemployment and just general severe unhappiness at the state of the economy. But it's also a district that had really, on the federal level, trended away from Democrats in recent elections, even though on the local level, it's really been ancestrally Democratic and almost all the local elected officials are Republican. And to sort of tie it into a lot of what you guys focus on, you know, I think actually, New York's ninth, if it has any similar districts, it might be to some in certain parts of the South or near the South, like maybe West Virginia or Arkansas, where You have districts where, you know, state senator, state rep, they might all be Democrats down the line, but boy, are they voting against the president, Democratic ticket on the national level.
Wow. Well, David, as I promised, we are going to turn south, and I thank you for giving me that answer and responding to my little surprise. But also on with us tonight, we have Wendy Davis and Catherine Smith. So I'm going to pass it over to them for some questions, beginning with Wendy. Go ahead, Wendy. Wendy, are you with me?
Uh-oh. Yes, sorry, I forgot to unmute. My apologies. I should know better than that. Hi, David.
Okay.
Thanks for joining us tonight. I wondered if you could speak briefly. We've got a special election in West Virginia, and then two other regularly scheduled governor's races in the South. What are we hearing about those? Are there any chances for our Democratic candidates? Certainly, you know, quite possibly in West Virginia.
West Virginia is looking pretty good. I think it's a little bit tighter than Democrats would like. We have Acting Governor Earl Ray Tomlin. He took office after Joe Manchin was elected to the Senate last year, and he's running against a businessman, sort of a fresh face with the ability for some self-funding named Bill Maloney. And a couple of recent public polls showed the race, within striking distance for Maloney. But from what I'm hearing, I think maybe the race might be widening out a bit. Tomlin has picked up a number of solid endorsements in recent days from important groups around the state and a number of newspaper endorsements. And while those don't necessarily mean very much in their own right, sort of it gives a sense of where the power players think the race is headed. And they want to bet on the right horse, and, you know, they want their guy in the state house. And if they're betting on Tomlin, then, you know, that's at least a positive sign. And the Republican Governors Association, though, it seems to be the race they're most interested in. They actually stopped spending in Kentucky because their candidate, David Williams, was so deeply unpopular and so far behind in the polls, and it seems like they've shifted that money to West Virginia instead to support Maloney. So I suspect that this one will be reasonably interesting on election night. I would not want to rule out an upset, but I would say that Tomlin is favored there. I already mentioned Kentucky. Man, I mean, for a state that otherwise seems to go so red on the federal level, boy, I don't think that Republicans could have nominated a worse candidate than David Williams. He's a state Senate president, but somehow he managed to ascend to that post without ever being very popular. And Governor Steve Beshear, the incumbent, he's had huge leads in the polls. The last couple of polls showed him up over 20 points, which is really quite stunning. And then,
wow,
Unfortunately, the other two races, Mississippi and Louisiana. Louisiana, a candidate filing closed recently, and not a single Democrat of any stature whatsoever filed. I think that the most prominent candidate is a teacher who has maybe raised a few thousand dollars this year. Bobby Jindal has something like close to $10 million in his campaign account. So there's no question that race is going to be a washout. Mississippi, Democrats nominated an interesting candidate, Mayor of Hattiesburg, Mayor Dupree. He is the first African-American, I believe, to win the Democratic nomination in Mississippi for the governor's race. Dupree is fighting against some serious trends toward the Republicans. And I would say that Lieutenant Governor Bryant is very heavily favored in that race. But that one, I'd say, is definitely more interesting than what's going on in Louisiana.
Well, let me ask you quickly, is the Democratic candidate's success in West Virginia and Kentucky, have they found a way to make it, to not nationalize it? I find that the Democrats in the South get, you know, clobbered when we let local races become national races. So have these candidates just found a nice magical way that we might translate to some of these other states to keep it local? To keep it about the local interest?
I wish there were a silver bullet. You know, Republicans certainly have tried, I think, a little bit more in Kentucky than in West Virginia to nationalize the race and, you know, bring in the specter of Obama. And I guess for whatever reason, the message hasn't really resonated. I think part of the reason is that in both cases, you're dealing with incumbents. Tomlin has only really been in office as acting governor for a year, and he wasn't elected, but Beshear was previously elected. And I think that when you have incumbent Democrats, then it becomes a little bit harder to start talking about issues outside of the state because these people have records to run on. And Beshear in particular has a longer record to run on since he's been in office almost 4 years. Of course, the question is, how do you get lucky enough to become governor, an incumbent in the first place? And in Beshear's case, when he was first elected back in 2007, he was elected against a deeply unpopular Republican against whom there were all sorts of accusations of corruption, Ernie Fletcher. Tomlin, of course, he had the advantage of being head of the state Senate, and he was elevated after, as I said, Joe Manchin went to the Senate. So, you know, I think that those two gentlemen in particular got lucky by being in the positions where they are. And I wish there were an answer on how to keep these races local versus national. The other big factor is they're running for state office. If they were running for Senate, I think it would be an entirely different situation.
Catherine, do you have a question for David?
Yes. So, David, you know, here in Georgia, we have awful redistricting going on. I mean, it's just been really awful. I don't know if you've looked at our maps or seen our...
I sure have.
It's really shocking how bold and, I mean, almost mean our Republican... I mean, it really is. It's amazing when you look at it. And we've been very lucky that our state legislators have been so united on, you know, 100% voting against these maps. But how is the redistricting? I mean, we think ours is probably going to go to court. I'm just wondering how many of the, if you have any idea of how many of the states that are going, well, we're all going through redistricting, if what the impact might be on the 2012 elections if these maps are sort of in flux between now and then. Like, we don't really know if we're going to be running on these maps or on the existing maps in 2012, and we probably won't know until qualifying, until just before qualifying. I'm wondering if other states are facing those same kind of challenges and what that might mean.
Absolutely. I think that the redistricting situation is in serious flux in a lot of states. Georgia is a little bit earlier in the process since the new map was only passed relatively recently, but it sounds like legal challenges are very likely. The two biggest right now are Texas and North Carolina. Texas is the furthest along. They are actually in the mid. There's several cases have been filed there, and a very big case just concluded a trial in San Antonio, though no ruling is expected because first the state of Texas is going to go through the process called preclearance. It's a term from the Voting Rights Act, which says the Department of Justice has to sign off on the maps for particular jurisdictions. So Texas first has to litigate the preclearance question before other cases can go forward. And it seems very, very likely that in Texas, the Republicans are not going to wind up with the gerrymander that they passed. It's going to be something that does afford greater minority representation. So the answer is that things, I think, will probably get a bit better for Democrats through the legal process. The problem is that it can take a long time. And in fact, in Texas's last round of redistricting, things were not fully resolved until 2006. So we could see elections under one set of lines next year, and then 2 years later, possibly a different set of lines, and 2 years after that, perhaps even a further set of lines, depending upon how extensive the litigation is. But I do see some upside for Democrats in these cases, but of course, you know, you never know how judges are going to rule.
Right, and it does present, you know, it's complicated for those of us, you know, in for instance, I live in Atlanta in Fulton County, and our Fulton delegation could change from, I think it's right now we have 7 Democrats and 4 Republicans, and with the new maps it looks like it'll be, you know, something like 8 Republicans and 3 Democrats, which is crazy because Atlanta is like, you know, a giant blue dot in the middle of a red sea. And but we it and then of course they've pitted white Democrats who've been elected for many years against, you know, black Democrats who have been in office for many years, by redrawing the lines so that they're now running against each other, which is, you know, the idea being to dilute the white Democratic population. At least that's what we can only assume from the fact that they've done it all over the place.
Right.
But it's hard because who's going to be running? We don't know. Like, is my representative, who's a young African American male, is he going to be running against? And he's a great representative. I love him. But is he going to be running against a woman who's been in the state house for many years and is a great progressive white liberal woman, who's holding an office in an adjacent district now? It's very, you know, we've talked a lot about how angry we are and how we need to challenge this, but logistically, it's really kind of a nightmare as someone who wants to get out and pound the pavement and start working for a candidate. We don't know who to work for. So it in many ways, aside from the evil doing of drawing the maps, the fact that they drew them so insanely also stops activists from becoming involved to a certain extent. So it's very frustrating. And I've read a little bit about what's going on in Texas, and that sounds like a big mess too. So, and then I guess there's some problems in California and Ohio, and so I just wonder how this will all affect us in the coming elections, but I guess we just have to wait and see. I wanted to also ask you, are there any elections or things going on in the South that we haven't asked you about that you think deserve some attention? I guess Florida probably.
You guys always have a lot of interesting races going on. The Florida Senate race, you know, Bill Nelson, I think he's a deceptively strong candidate. And I'm just amazed that Florida Republicans have not found a stronger potential opponent for him. I mean, I can understand not wanting to run against Nelson, but I think they'd give it a better shot than that. So I think we look like we might be in the process of at least somewhat dodging a bullet there based on their sort of weak field. The Virginia Senate race, last time I did your show, I remember I rattled off a list of Senate races, and one of my commenters said, "David, how could you forget Virginia?" So this time I'm not going to forget Virginia. There was a Quinnipiac poll that came out just this past week that showed exactly what every other single poll has showed, which this race is a serious dead heat. Tim Kaine, the Democrat, former DNC chair, and George Allen, of course, the infamous former senator and former governor, both in the low to mid-40s. I think they were separated by a point, maybe two at most. And I think that one is going to be a really, really serious race once the money starts to flow there, and boy, will it flow. That one, you're gonna, if you're anywhere in the air vicinity of Virginia, you're gonna be seeing a lot of ads on TV. And I think that one's gonna go down to the wire. I think that could be a toss up all the way to the very end. The question, you know, and to sort of link this back to the question early on about, you know, could New York 9, you know, what message does that send nationally? You know, maybe if things continue to stay the way they are or continue to get worse, particularly economically speaking, maybe Barack Obama really does drag down a guy like Tim Kaine. I mean, after all, he was Obama's DNC chair. It's hard to get more closely associated with the president than that. And if Obama really is going to be a big drag like that, that could be a difference maker. I think that Tim Kaine could conceivably do better in Virginia than the president does, but, you know, is it better enough?
Wow.
I feel bad you guys had me on, and here I am such a wet blanket.
Well, you know, sometimes the truth hurts.
Yeah.
We have to be optimistic, though. I mean, you can't be... If you watch these debates with the Republican candidates, you kind of have to be optimistic. You can't imagine that anybody would... Well, I say that, but we elected George Bush twice, so what can I say?
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. You know, I'm not old enough to have remembered this personally, but I've certainly been told this by enough people that, you know, there were Democrats in the late 70s who were rooting for Reagan to win the GOP nomination because, of course, you know, how could this nutcase former actor, you know, how could he win the presidency? And, you know, 8 years later, boy, were the Republicans laughing at us. So, you know, Rick Perry, as kind of crazy as he may seem, or maybe crazy is not the right word, but maybe as extreme as he may seem, I would not want to say that he's incapable of getting elected president. And,
oh, I wouldn't say that either at all.
We need to be careful what we wish for.
Well, I will say that I voted in the election when I am old enough to remember Reagan, and I voted in that election, the first one, and I was working at the polls all day, and I didn't watch any returns because we weren't allowed to. And I got in the car to come home, and I turned on the radio, and President Carter was about to give his concession speech, and I honestly did not believe it. I mean, I just couldn't believe that we could elect him. I mean, I honestly was like, I just didn't believe it. I thought I had entered into some bizarro world or something. So,
well, after two terms of Reagan and two terms of George W. Bush, we may well be living in that bizarro world.
Yes, I sometimes do believe that. Go ahead, Tim. You had a question, I think.
I was wanting to ask you about Bev Perdue. She seems to have rebounded a bit lately in the polls up there, and I was wondering what you thought about that, whether it was the effects of her handling of the crisis with the hurricane, or if this governor who had been given up for dead actually has a fighting chance at reelection next year.
That's a really, really interesting question, and I think that Bev Perdue's situation in North Carolina is definitely one that has surprised me, because I think you're right. I think just about everyone had given her up for dead. And there's a lot of polling out of North Carolina because public policy polling, that's where they're located, so they constantly poll the governor's race there. And the numbers have been bad for years, almost practically since Perdue got elected. But two things happened recently, one of which you mentioned was her very effective response to Hurricane Irene. The other has been a little bit longer and more ongoing, and I think could perhaps provide a more sustained bounce for her, which is that the Republicans took control of the legislature last year, and as terrible as a thing that may be, that gives Perdue a real chance to stop a gang of pretty unpopular guys. The legislature is not popular, doesn't poll well in North Carolina, and they have pursued your typical radical Republican agenda. And Perdue has vetoed a lot of stuff, and including a deeply unpopular budget, which had all kinds of unpopular cuts, I believe, including to education. And the legislature's managed to override her vetoes in a number of cases, but she keeps getting good press for it. And, you know, if you get to be the guy who says, or the woman in this case, who says, you know, I vetoed cuts to education, that's a pretty powerful platform to be able to run on. The question is, you know, will it be enough to save her? She's still in the low 40s in the polls. Everyone knows her. It's hard to bounce back from that. But I think, as you were alluding, the last couple of polls were the closest that we've ever seen. I think PPP had one, and I think there was another one. It may have been from Magellan. I could be wrong. But both of them showed the race closer than it had ever been between Perdue and Pat McCrory, former mayor of Charlotte. So those of us who are ready to write her off as dead, myself included, I think it looks like we called time of death too early on this one. I think there may still be some life in this race yet.
All right. David, I want to turn back national for a minute. Because unless there is a late entry into the presidential race on the Republican side, like Palin or Giuliani or somebody like that. We pretty much have the GOP bill set. And one of these people who we're watching in all these interesting debates will be the Republican nominee. Now, who do you think at this point that might be and why?
For a long time, I had been betting on Romney. And I got to say, at this point, I feel like I want to give the edge to Perry. And here's why. I'll try to give it in a nutshell. I think that Romney's best argument was always that he was the most electable, that he pulled the best, that he had the best appeal to the center. And that's not an argument. That's an argument that you can make to someone's head, not one that you can make to their heart. And primary voters, I think it's true among Democrats and Republicans, but I think it's definitely true of Republican primary voters, are going to be more receptive to appeals from the heart. I think that's how humans always are. I think emotions are often much stronger than our intellect. And Rick Perry appeals to a lot of emotions of the conservative base, and he is one of them. He makes that clear based on what he says, how he conducts himself, the kind of things he supported, the kinds of things he's opposed. And he's had a few stumbles here and there, like with the HPV vaccinations. But for the most part, I think he's made it really clear that when he speaks to movement conservatives, that he's one of them. And it's very, very hard for Romney to make that case. And I think that that gives Perry the edge in scoring the GOP nomination. I'm very curious to hear what you guys think, especially since you've been a little bit more up close and personal with Rick Perry all these past years.
Yeah. I was just gonna say, actually throw a question right back to you about Governor Perry. Let's say he is the nominee, and we have discussed his weak points, and they are numerous, particularly when he opens his mouth. And I was just wondering if those weaknesses are going to be much more glaring in front of a general election audience, which is quite different from the typical Republican primary voter.
You have to think that they are. Let's just take one issue, for example, where Rick Perry's really put himself out there, Social Security. He has said that he thinks it's unconstitutional, that it's a Ponzi scheme, and for a certain segment of the GOP electorate, that really, you know, tickles their fancy. That gets them excited to hear that. For most Americans, especially older Americans, no one wants to hear that kind of stuff. And if Barack Obama gets out there and he'll have $1 billion to fund his campaign, literally, and hammers Rick Perry on Social Security, I think that could be a very effective issue. It could play particularly well in Florida, of course, with its large retiree population. So, yeah, Rick Perry does have his vulnerabilities, and I think that it's harder for someone like Romney to exploit them in the GOP primary than it will be for President Obama, who will, I think, have a much easier time of making an issue out of a lot of Rick Perry's issues.
Okay, well, let's jump in and ask Catherine or Wendy if they have something to add here.
This is Catherine. I agree with you, David. I think that I thought for sure that Mittens was going to be the nominee until just a few days ago. But as I see Rick Perry and as I hear, I watch the debates and try to make light of them on Twitter, because if I don't, I'll just cry myself to sleep. I think that he appeals to that, both the Tea Party, who I think are going to be very instrumental in electing in the primary. I think they're going to be the a big showing in the primaries, and also to the, you know, sort of traditional conservative right. I think that they can overlook some of the things that they don't like about Rick Perry. I don't think they can. I think that he is sort of straight out of central casting for the, you know, it, to me, he's a little bit scarier than George Bush because I think he's smarter and he's I do. I think he's – I mean, I don't know anything about his educational background, but he does seem a little bit sharper than George Bush. So I think that my concern is – I mean, I don't like to ask, you know, be careful what you wish for, like you said earlier. But the one that scares me that in these debates, and I know he doesn't have a chance to make the nominee – to become the nominee is I know I can't remember his name.
He scared his name out of you.
Yeah, what did you say, Wendy? Hudson. Because he's, like, very smart and, you know, he believes in evolution. He believes in global warming. I think he would appeal to independents and to traditional, what I call traditional Republicans, the Republicans of my, you know, parents'
that's
age.
Governor Huntsman.
Yeah, Huntsman. But what do you think, Wendy?
Well, you know, I'm in this sort of bind of being, you know, part of me wants them to nominate the craziest loony in their loony bin, but part of me thinks that if we screw up, their nominee would be president, and I don't want it to be the worst one. And Huntsman is the only one to me who doesn't really frighten me yet, and maybe it's just because I don't know him very well. But again, I don't know how he gets through their primary. But I hope he hangs in there because, I mean, a little dose of reasonableness will be a nice balance to the wackiness that we've seen over and over again from them.
Well, David, let me ask you about that right quick before we let you go. I've always been one of those guys, and I am old enough to remember way back. I remember Jack Kennedy. I remember the night he talked about the missiles in Cuba. I remember responsible, stable Republicans like Everett Dirksen and Gerald Ford and even Richard Nixon. Those people were people of some talent, people of reason. And I've always hoped that the Republicans nominate their best candidate on the off chance that they would actually win, that it would be better for the country. Am I right to do that, or as a partisan Democrat, should I wish for the crazy candidate that we
need? You know, it's a tough call, but I'll tell you, I think like Wendy was saying, there's no way in hell John Huntsman can win the nomination. So
no.
Right now you're rooting for either Mitt Romney or Rick Perry, and I do think Romney is more electable. I do think Perry is a hell of a lot more dangerous. And I still have not made up my mind. Would I rather face Mittens and, you know, if he wins, maybe things are not an entire disaster. But, you know, knowing that if we face him, he has a better chance of winning. Or would I rather go up against Perry, think we have a better chance to beat him, and then be really, really frightened when he's president? I haven't made up my mind yet. The good thing is we can do whatever we want, especially when we sit at home watching these Republican debates with a big bowl of popcorn, because who we root for ain't going to affect nothing in the end.
That's true. Well, David, we have kept you about 5 minutes past our live air time. We are now in the download time. And listen, we really appreciate you coming on with us tonight. As always, thank you so much for being on the Kudzu Vine. Thank you so much for what you do on the front lines for us. And I hope that as the campaign heats up, we can get you to come right back here and give us some more of your great insight.
Well, thank you very much. It's really been my pleasure to do the show both times. I definitely want to come back on, so you obviously know how to reach me. And thank you guys for everything you do with this program.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, sir. Good night.
David.
Have a good night.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, folks. Thank you, Wendy. Good night.
Thanks, Wendy.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Thanks a lot.